Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 162 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com, Crowe with an E. Join the discussion at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on PRN.fm or download the MP3 after broadcast on iTunes or other podcast aggregators. You can also listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. You will be responsible for any long-distance charges. I know you're listening, and you haven't gone to patreon.com/infectiousmyth yet to donate one measly dollar a month. Yes, you. I'm waiting. You might think this show is taped, but today it's live, and through the power of the NSA, I'm watching you. We'll move on when you go to Patreon and sign up for a donation to help me keep doing this great show. And by the smile on your face, I could tell that you agree. That's better. Patreon.com/infectiousmyth. You'll feel better after you donate. Thank you. I do appreciate your comments and your suggestions for guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. Thanks for listening and for recommending this show to your friends. Now let's get to this week's interview. I've been covering the HPV vaccine a lot. Maybe some of you are getting bored with it, but I think it's an important subject that brings a lot of things together. Scientific issues and social issues, the issues of coercing or mandating vaccines, scientific flaws in clinical trials, especially for vaccines, denial of the adverse effects that do occur from the vaccines, and many other things. I hope you enjoy listening to it, and I'd really like to hear your thoughts. Today, I'm pleased to welcome back Joan Shenton, probably my most frequent guest. That's not because I like her a lot, which I do, but because she's been so damn productive recently. And also Andy Reese, who also has been very productive, and I also like him too. Joan was born in Chile and spent many of her young years in South America. She studied at Oxford and in 1964 joined the BBC. She went independent in 1978, founding Meditel Productions, and did numerous medical documentaries for the BBC, notably Channel 4. As Wikipedia says, in the late 1980s, Meditel took up the cause of HIV/AIDS denialism. Perhaps more accurately, what Meditel really did was to give a voice to the scientists who disputed the cause of AIDS and to those with a scarlet letter, a positive HIV test, who resisted the toxic drug AZT, which was the only possible therapy in those days. This got her blacklisted, and it was difficult for her to produce films for many years. More recently, with funding from Bob Lepo and Christian Fiala, she started making films again, this time with Andy Reese, such as Positively False, Birth of a Heresy, titled after her critical AIDS book of the same name, and Positive Hell, about a group of seropositive people in Spain who survived without AIDS illnesses and without AIDS drugs since the 1980s. Sadly, we have to report that a second member of the group featured in Positive Hell has died of a non-AIDS-related cause. We believe it was a heart attack. Andy Reese is a Festival Award-winning documentary filmmaker and video artist, producing work for television and art galleries. He incorporates a range of artistic disciplines within a social, political, and cultural context. His films include Cargo in 2004, Homecoming 2010, Positively False, Birth of a Heresy, which was 2011, Positive Hell 2014, and this year Endgame, Assisted Dying in UK legislation. And we'll also talk about a new documentary that Andy and Joan are working on together. But the main topic of this podcast is the recent production of three short documentaries called Sacrificial Virgins, about the HPV vaccine. Welcome to the show, Andy and Joan.
Thank you, David. Andy and I like you too.
Well, that's good. Oh, we have a mutual admiration society going on here.
We do like it.
Okay, so this is a three-part documentary series, and you don't have to go to the theater to see it. It's available on YouTube, and I will include the link. There's a YouTube page which has all three documentaries on it, so you can go and watch them. And how long are they, just to give people an idea of what they're getting into if they watch them?
Oh, you know the answer to that.
It's they're 3 times 10 minutes, which then come together as 1 half-hour festival cut.
Okay.
So not.
But the festival cut, Andy, isn't generally available yet.
That is true.
Yes.
True.
Okay. So you can watch them all in 10-minute increments, which sort of suits the modern age of short attention spans, which has infected me as well. So it's not like you're going to be sitting down to watch 2 hours of a video. They say what they have to say in a relatively short amount of time. So let's first talk about the three parts. The first is called Not for the Greater Good. So what subject about the HPV vaccine is this covering?
Shall I start?
Go ahead, Joan.
Okay, the first one, Not for the Greater Good, examines the science behind the HPV vaccine and finds it deeply flawed. And we do this through Peter Duesberg, Professor of Molecular Biology at Berkeley, California, and Dr. Christian Fiala, obstetrics and gynecologist in Vienna, consultant specialist. And we challenge the fact, well, we challenge the need for the HPV vaccine and say not only is it not needed, it's because it's not proved to have a causal relationship with cervical cancer.
So, I mean, one thing I've quoted several times on the show, and people are probably getting tired of it, but the Nobel Prize was awarded in 2008, not only for the supposed discovery of HIV to Luc Montagnier and a co-worker, but also to a guy named Zurhausen for the supposed discovery that HPV causes cervical cancer, and now they're saying other types of cancers. But one of the things it said in that citation was that it will be decades before we know whether a vaccine will reduce the number of cases of cervical cancer. Mm-hmm. What else did you find that was critical of the causal link between HPV and cervical cancer?
Well, causation, I mean, association doesn't prove causation. And as Professor Duesberg says, what happens is that we may get an early infection with human papillomavirus, and that usually causes warts. And for millennia, our immune systems have been dealing with the warts, right?
Mm-hmm.
But once you had that infection for warts, HPV, human papillomavirus, leaves what Duesberg calls fossils. And these fossils remain, but they are not active viral particles. They are not replicating. They're not making DNA. They're simply fossils. The trouble is, later on, say 30 years on, a young woman with cervical cancer might show positive to these fossils of HPV. But he says they are nothing to do with the cause of cervical cancer. And in fact, I'm not sure of the proportion, but I think about a third of women who die of cervical cancer have no HPV.
And there's also many women who have HPV which disappears, right? They no longer are positive. It's believed that it can resolve itself of its own. I mean, is cervical cancer, I think your examples are mostly in the UK, is cervical cancer a big problem in the UK when it comes to, compared to other types of cancer like breast cancer or lung cancer?
Do you know,
I think the simple answer to that, David, is probably no, but that doesn't seem to affect the mandatory vaccination, which the UK and many other countries are insisting upon.
Well, it's kind of the it's the one case is too many. I mean, It reminds me of in the United States, right? Whenever there is a terrorist attack, you know, even if only one or two people are killed, it's like, well, that's one too many. And yet 30,000 people get killed by cars and 30,000 by guns, and that doesn't seem to be too many, right? Like, we pay attention to diseases, some cases out of proportion to the impact that they have. And I guess, you know, you could say the flaw in the argument is, like, one case is too many, is that it would be great to prevent every case of cervical cancer, even if it wasn't a significant cancer, as long as there were no side effects, as long as there was nobody harmed by the intervention. But the problem, I don't know what the population of England is, like 50 million or 60 million or something, half of which is female. That's millions of women who are going to be exposed to the vaccine. So even a low rate of adverse effects could overwhelm the number of people saved if it does indeed stop cervical cancer.
Well, yes, very true, especially when you read the potential side effects of the vaccine, which are pretty scary in themselves.
And what have you found with side effects? Like, what have you been dealing with in terms of serious? I mean, if people get a headache afterwards or a fever and it goes away, that's, you know, people accept that as the price of a vaccine, but we're talking about things that are more serious than that.
And Andy's going to answer that because he and I were there to see some of the seriously damaged women, young girls. But what I simply wanted to add to what you just said is that the side effects to the HPV vaccine are the highest of any existing vaccine. And in America, Duesberg said that they are higher than the sum total of all other vaccine side effects.
And when you look at you know, when you read about it, I mean, the possible reactions. I mean, it's as if you're talking about chemotherapy. You know, limb pain, paralysis, chronic fatigue, heart complications, dizziness, anxiety, hair loss, hallucination, insomnia, cardiac issues, autoimmune disease, migraine, loss of vision, backache, sensitivity to light, etc., etc., ceasing of the menstrual cycle, and on some websites, and even death. Now, that is pretty scary. What we've seen is we have heard of cases where it did result in death, notably in Austria, and we have met three women in the UK who, to all intent and purpose, have very little quality of life because they are essentially paralyzed.
Yes, I mean, looking at those beautiful young women who had their whole lives in front of them and, you know, had dreams of career, family, things like that, it's pretty heartbreaking. It's pretty heartbreaking to see those women in a wheelchair. We just lost Joan, so I'll try to add her back.
Yes, it is, David. It's terrifying because, you know, it's one thing to read statistics about the percentage of girls who may be affected, but it's quite something else to actually go and see them.
It was shocking to see just how weak they were. I mean, they're not entirely paralyzed, but pretty damn close to entirely paralyzed.
Yes, and they... And not only that, and not only is that terrifying for them and the family, they are incapacitated to all intent and purpose. They need, round the clock attention. And possibly more difficult to understand is they have no idea what can be done. There is no, in two of the cases, that we speak about in the film, they've been to the hospital and they've been told, or the parents have been told, and in fact the youngest one, 13 years old, was told to her face by the medical profession that it was psychosomatic.
That really blows my mind. I mean, doctors are believed by society to be scientists, and yet they come up with these judgments with no evidence. I mean, certainly, you know, if somebody has mysterious symptoms, then you might want to consider that they're psychologically induced, because the brain is very powerful and it can convince you you're sick. But to assert that that's the case, when there's a potential cause, a vaccine, and everybody admits that vaccines do sometimes cause adverse reactions, seems entirely unscientific to me.
Well, yes, especially as a medical practitioner, if your NHS or your country is going to administer, indeed, make it almost mandatory that these people, these girls, have the vaccine, you're going to need to look into the vaccine. And the one particular vaccine that is out there, you know, commonly known as the most dangerous vaccine ever, never went through its full clinical trial stage.
There's two HPV vaccines, Gardasil and Cervarix. Like, how do they differ? Are they both still in use?
I can answer that one. Yeah. I lost you for a few minutes, David.
Yeah. Welcome back, Joan.
Can I answer that point? Because I have in front of me my notes from Professor Christopher Exley, whom we interviewed as a world authority on aluminium toxicity.
We'll get to aluminium very soon, yeah.
Oh, you're not onto that yet.
No, I was just saying, what are the names of the vaccines that are in use? Which one is mostly in use in the UK?
Gardasil and Cervarix, and the two things that were really wrong with them, I can tell you now, wrong with the trials, because Andy just mentioned.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Like, what was wrong with these trials? I mean, the trials didn't prove that the vaccines reduced cervical cancer, because that would have probably been statistically impossible. The trials would have to go on for decades in order to determine that. They just reduced the rate of, like, so-called precancerous lesions. But what do you think was wrong with the trials that got them approved?
Well, there are two things very, very wrong. Mm-hmm. Both Gardasil and Cervarix were fast-tracked, which means they only went through stage one of the trials. After that, they were launched onto these poor, defenseless young girls. Now, the trouble with that is that Gardasil, for example, used the normal aluminium adjuvant. That's the thing you add. An adjuvant is what you add to make the vaccine effective. And normally they would put, and over the past 90 years, we've had aluminium hydroxide as the normal adjuvant. But what they did, Gardasil, the manufacturers of, they included a sulfated version of aluminium in the composition. And this, as Sir Exley says, is a completely new one, one which has essentially not been used before. And this was added to the sort of compound, you know, the composition.
Right.
Now, it wasn't after the trials. They did the trials with that, but then they stopped the trials pretty early on. Professor Exley requested, and I've never said this before on air,
this is a genuine scoop.
It is.
Okay.
Request some of the Gardasil adjuvant material from the manufacturers, right? And they said they wouldn't disclose it. They wouldn't give it to him because he wanted to test it in his lab, right? Closed doors.
This is a problem with a lot of things. Pesticides contain so-called inert ingredients, and often testing is done with the pesticide, not with the full formulation. And here we have, in this case, okay, there was some testing done with the full formulation, but somebody might want to test just the aluminum adjuvant in mice or rats to see what it does. And I presume, did he ask them for documentation on safety testing on this aluminum adjuvant?
I'm not sure. He just asked if he could test it in his lab, but he wasn't given it. And I'll just add this second point. Cervarix, it used an adjuvant, the normal one, a form of aluminium hydroxide. But after the trials had ended, they added a second aluminium adjuvant, a lipid. And Exley says, all of the safety trials for Cervarix did not use the mixture of the aluminium hydroxide and the lipid in their trials. They chose simply only to use the aluminium hydroxide. Well, that is unacceptable.
I would just like to address, not you two, but all the people out there who are strong supporters of vaccines and who are such strong supporters that they don't want people criticizing vaccines because they fear the impact on public health. The problem about not having discussions with vaccines is that manufacturers can cut corners. They can, you know, change their formulation and decide it's way too time consuming and expensive to go back through all the testing again, and maybe deep down they think it's also dangerous. They might find problems. This is what happens when there's no discussion about vaccines. You don't have to object to all vaccines to want vaccines to be rigorously tested. And saying they're rigorously tested when that's not true is a lie.
David, can I just interject there for a second?
Yes, it is my show, but I'll let you talk.
Oh, no, sorry. I'm sorry. No, go ahead.
No. Go ahead, Andy.
No. That's a joke, Andy.
That's Canadian humor.
No, and I love it. Just like your shirt is Canadian humor, which is a great shirt for radio. Your point is very pertinent, and the reason I was going to interject at that point was because, you know, I don't think anyone's asking for the manufacturers to feel obliged to put, you know, fast tracked and flawed on their boxes, but. Yeah. I think it comes down to choice, and I think a very important part of the film, notwithstanding the science or lack of it behind it, is the legitimacy of it and it being mandatory, you know.
You're absolutely right, Andy. You are, because you say no choice. There's no informed consent either.
Yeah, well, I think that's the right word, right? Informed consent requires two things. It requires that you have access to all the information you need to make a decision, and you have the right to make a negative decision. You have the right to refuse. Informed consent, where you have to accept it, but you're allowed to read the label first, that's not informed consent. But you said mandatory. I understood that in the UK there were no mandatory vaccines.
No, it's not mandatory here, but in Australia, and we've included Australia, obviously, in our films, if you don't give your child these vaccines, they take away your social security benefit completely.
Yes. So that's no problem for the middle class who don't get them. But for poor people, they're just to shut up and accept their status as guinea pigs. I guess the assumption is that poor people aren't smart enough to enjoy the right to informed consent.
Can I just, because I've been hogging it a bit, although I lost you for a few minutes, I'd really love...
We did that deliberately, Joan, because you were hogging it so much, I just disconnected you.
I'd like Andy to describe to you what it was like, if we are able to talk about her, to walk into the room of young Mia, who is 12 years old, and to see how she was strapped into her wheelchair. Andy, can you do that? Are we allowed to talk about Mia?
Yes, of course we are. We're allowed to talk about Mia, and interestingly enough, Mia is the one girl that we had followed that doesn't appear in the film, because Mia's parents had been entertaining the press, the tabloid press in the UK, and they were essentially told by the social services that if they were to make any more quote unquote trouble, then they would take Mia into care.
Yeah.
And that, wow. for a 12-year-old girl who in the last 6 months has been one bedbound or confined to a wheelchair and it can't walk, is, you know, sporadic spasms, involuntary convulsions that go on all night for reasons unknown.
Right.
Can't go to school. The only thing she can do is sing, and so she has singing lessons. But she certainly can't, you know, move around and walk, etc., etc. And in addition to all of that, and you know, the medical terror of that, to be told that she might get taken away from her parents because of their anger and discontent with arguably a product that they felt obliged to allow Mia to have, that's ridiculous. And Mia, very, very sadly, she's 13 now, and she can hardly move, and she has no idea whether she will recover. The parents have no idea, and the parents have been muted, and that's the reason why, sadly, she doesn't appear in the film.
Although we do have Ruby and we have Chloe, who are absolutely brilliant young women who have been very severely damaged neurologically. And when David allows me a little later, I'd like to explain why this flipping aluminium and how it can get into the brain and become free range and cause this terrible neurological damage.
Yeah, well, okay, let's talk about that. There's no, I mean, aluminium is a metal, obviously.
Yeah, we need it in our bodies.
It has no known biological use. Right, copper is also an electrical metal. Is found in very small quantities in the human body and has a function. Yeah. Aluminum, as far as I can tell, has no function. Just like mercury or arsenic, there are metals that the body tries to get rid of. So yes, tell us, how does aluminum get in the brain, and what do we think it does when it gets there?
Well, Professor Exley says that what happens is that in order to strengthen the vaccine, they add more aluminium adjuvant. Mm-hmm. What happens is that when the injection is given, the cells come rushing to that site, mm-hmm. and they carry a bit of aluminium away with them.
Right.
And in some people, these cells travel through the body and can penetrate the blood-brain barrier. And then what happens is that the cell carrying the aluminium becomes destroyed, and the aluminium is left free range in the brain.
Right. And that's like that would be like a short circuit. I mean, it'd be like, you know, opening up a computer and sort of dripping liquid metal in it, and who knows what would happen, right? If you're lucky and you hit something which doesn't have a connector, nothing happens. But if you happen to hit an important connector with a lot of power, you could blow the whole thing.
It's a very good analogy, David. Yeah.
And I've interviewed Chris Exley and also the other Chris Shaw at UBC, both experts in aluminum and both very concerned. And they didn't come into this as anti-vaccine people. They came in as aluminum experts who were asked, I guess, at some point, you know, what do you think about injecting aluminum into the human body? And they knew enough to be very concerned about it.
Yeah, David, can you explain, because you did it very well, why it is totally wrong to have added aluminium to the placebo group in these trials?
Right. Well, that's in general. This is a really ugly development in medicine. I mean, a placebo is seen by the average person on the street. If they know what a placebo is, you would have a vaccine and you'd have a saline solution, something that you can convince the person that they've been vaccinated, right? You stick a needle in their arm, you inject saline solution, the person goes away thinking they might have received a vaccine in a trial, right, of placebo versus vaccine. So you have the psychological impact, which is important, because if you have a group who is injected and a group that's not injected, we know that the people who aren't injected, no, they weren't, and no, they didn't get the vaccine, and their report on side effects and things like that will be colored by nothing happened to me, no, I didn't get a headache, no, I didn't get a fever, right? So in order to balance off reports of side effects, you need to have a placebo and a vaccine. But what they also want to find out, in many cases, is this drug or vaccine better than a previous drug? And this has led to trials where there's no placebo, but there is, you know, old drug A and new drug B. And that's sort of been extended to vaccines where you have basically a vaccine without the biological component. So it has the aluminum, it has all of the other things that go up to make the vaccine. What this means is if there are adverse reactions to any of the ingredients, of the non-biological ingredients of the vaccine, those will be balanced in the two trial arms. So if aluminum causes side effects, you will get the same number in the so-called placebo as with the real vaccine. What should be done, if they want to do something like this, they should have a true placebo, then the mock vaccine, and then the true vaccine, and they can then tell, does the biological component cause additional side effects, and things like that. But yes, it's very unscientific to use a placebo that is not a true placebo, because it masks the side effects.
Substance, shouldn't it, David? And Dr. Christian Fiala says, in science, this could be called bias, but he said it is cheating.
Yes, it is, because you're basically covering up the adverse effects. If you're concerned about the aluminum, so you put aluminum in the mock, in the pseudo placebo, then you know you have 10 adverse effects in the placebo group and about 10 in the vaccine group, and you do a statistical analysis and you say there's no difference. Therefore, the vaccine does not cause this side effect. It's just coincidental that people became paralyzed during the trial. It had nothing to do with the vaccine. Yeah, I would say it's closer to fraud than, I mean, cheating is maybe not quite a strong enough word.
I do have one other little tiny topic.
Mm-hmm.
Do you mind if I bring it up? And that is, it is a concern of Dr. Fiala's that there is a very long delay before neurological symptoms appear after these vaccinations.
Yeah, that is an important issue. It's not like these girls collapsed in the doctor's office.
Yeah. So he says that what happens with the orthodox approach is that the subjects are observed for 30 minutes after receiving the injection and were asked to report serious adverse reactions occurring 1 to 15 days after the injection. But Dr. Fiala says that it takes 4 to 6 weeks at least for neurological problems to occur. And what is happening is that none of these neurological problems are being associated with the vaccine.
Right, right. Is there an explanation for that? Because people might say, oh, you know, you're just trying to pin on the vaccine something that's not related. Like, if the vaccine is harmful, it should be obvious quickly. Why would it take over a month to get the first serious symptoms?
Neurological symptoms happen very, very slowly. Mm. Consequently, you will miss most of it, if not everything, if you do not use a long-term approach.
Yeah. Yes. So, I mean, that would be fairly easy to set up a trial where you have a true placebo and you follow people for a year. Because you're using a placebo, if the people with the placebo have a lower rate of a particular side effect than the vaccine, if it's statistically significantly different, then you have a pretty good idea that it's caused by the vaccine. But you have to do that trial.
And he says, consequently, no doctor will make a link between a neurological symptom and the vaccine.
I mean, that's another issue. Doctors have a bit of a conflict of interest because they promote vaccines. They don't want to really think that they could destroy somebody's life through what's a routine procedure in their office. They're not really, it's harder for them to be open-minded about this. And there's also probably fear, because if a doctor goes off half-cocked, let's say it's you know, he gives a new drug to a patient, and 3 days later the patient has a heart attack, and he starts writing letters that this drug causes a heart attack. It might have been coincidental, and he will be savaged by the drug company. He'll be totally destroyed. So I think there's also fear here. If I start saying this vaccine is causing serious adverse effects, what's going to happen to me?
And also, Andy, you can speak, I know, about the awfulness of all these young girls being told that their problems are all in their mind.
Well, that's the terrifying thing. I mean, it must be pretty difficult for anyone of any age to be told that their symptoms are psychosomatic. But when it's obvious that, you know, you've had the second of a three-part vaccination, and within hours, I mean, certainly within a couple of days, your body has, you know, has begun to shut down. To be told that it's all in your head, go away and have a hot bath and, you know, think positively. That's, I mean, not only is that terrifying, but it's confusing. And for anyone of that age, of any age, but for that age, I think it is particularly heartbreaking.
And the other problem is that these girls are being lumped in with a syndrome called ME, myalgic encephalitis, which is a syndrome. And I think that is wrong, because they do not have ME. They have aluminium toxicity. That is my...
Yes, I mean, how many diseases that we later found had an environmental cause were blamed on some mysterious virus or bacteria or causes unknown in the past?
So true.
What about the parents? Like, I would imagine that the parents feel guilty because they asked their daughters to have this vaccine.
I think it's a mixture, David, of guilt, total helplessness, and an undying need to be there for the girls 24 hours a day, and that, you know, it is compromising everything. I mean, the one girl who is the worst, actually, Chloe. I mean, she can't swallow, and therefore she can't have solid food. And the day that we were there, there was a delivery of all of her powders and nutrients for a couple of weeks, and literally it was enough to stock up a small garage. And that has to be administered three times a day by her mum. So mum has absolutely no life at all.
Through a tube, Andy, into her tummy.
Yes.
That's heartbreaking. Two other things that I wonder if the parents feel are a sense of betrayal, because they probably realize, like I did at one point, that they'd had faith in vaccines because they had been told for so many years that vaccines are safe and effective and it's irresponsible not to get them. So betrayal. And then the second thing is a worry about their daughters, and I guess in the future maybe sons. What happens when we're gone, when we're too old to look after our daughter, when we're 80 or 90 and our daughter's 50 or 60, who's going to look after our daughter then? That must be on their mind as well.
Of course it is, yeah. But you see, it goes from helplessness to anger to guilt to concern to worry, and then all of that is just sort of a potpourri of, well, we've just got to get on with it.
Yes.
And from that comes this extraordinary kind of a strength which obviously is completely necessary for the kid, because the kid not only can't do anything, but is, you know, she has no idea what's going on.
Can I, Andy, just ask David a crucial question that's crossing my mind all the time? Every time I talk about this, of course, people who believe in vaccines say, but it's deeply irresponsible if we don't ask our daughters to have this, because they will be the few and the others will become infected. Well, this whole herd immunity thing is such a massive subject. And frankly, Jad Adams, who was our researcher many years ago, he made a brilliant film called Whooping Cough, A Shot in the Dark, with Professor Gordon Stewart, the late lamented. Yes. And, you know, this whole concept of herd immunity has to be challenged, David, and I don't know how.
Yeah, so, I mean, herd immunity is the idea that if you get 80 or 90% of people vaccinated, that it will protect the rest. But it seems to have morphed into the opposite, that even when, like in the United States, vaccine rates are often very high, often over 90%. And now people who aren't vaccinating are told that they're being irresponsible, as if the vaccine didn't actually protect the majority. I mean, everybody admits, okay, there's children with cancer taking chemotherapy that can't be vaccinated, et cetera, et cetera. So not everybody can be vaccinated, even if you believe everything good about vaccines.
That's a very good point.
But if we've achieved herd immunity with this high rate of vaccination, how could a few people who decide not to get vaccinated be a problem? I think the problem is this fear that, okay, if we have 90% vaccinated and then we sort of slack off and we tell people, okay, it's your choice, it'll quickly drop to 80 or 70% and then we lose herd immunity. But I would be very interested to know if there's actually any scientific evidence that herd immunity even works with these vaccines.
I would agree with you that that has to be looked into very seriously.
Are the parents organizing at all? Like, I interviewed a man from a British society of, like, HPV vaccine-injured daughters, but did you see that in the interviews? Did parents talk about being involved with an organization?
Well, yes, of course, because the AHVID, which is Association of HPV Vaccine-Injured Daughters, is run by Frieda Birrell. She has hundreds of girls in this country and families, and she's in touch with people across the world. And I have to tell you that yesterday, and I still don't know what the result was, there was a meeting between AHVID and a company of lawyers who are highly specialized in personal injury and class actions to see if this couldn't go to court, because I firmly believe, and you know my position on this, that we will never get to first base unless a case goes through the court or a class action. Then this damaging medication will be withdrawn, but it won't be withdrawn before that. Japan has 120 cases going through the courts. Colombia has 700 young girls injured in a class action. Judicial Watch in New York is doing litigation. One day, one of these cases will go through the court and then the drug will have to be withdrawn. And my last point on this is that our advisor for many, many years, Professor Andrew Herxheimer, who died last year, he said it can take 10 years to withdraw a dangerous drug. So we have to fight very hard to stop more people being injured.
Yes, and will those injured include boys? Like, I hear more and more that HPV vaccine can also prevent penile cancers and things like that. Is this happening in the United Kingdom or elsewhere where you talk to people?
There's a push now to vaccinate all boys, and I really don't know where we are with that, but there are articles appearing now and then saying it's an outrage that we're not vaccinating all the boys. Quite frankly, I don't know how the boys could be carriers, or they don't get cervical cancer, so I really haven't looked into this enough.
Yeah, well, I'm sure they will find a statistical association between the presence of HPV and a cancer, which they will assume is causative, and then they will push for the boys. And then after that, when their sales start to go down again, then they'll have to say, okay, well, all those adults who never got vaccinated as children, they need to be vaccinated as well, right?
Oh.
It goes on until you saturate the market, and then you go on to something else, right? You lose interest in it because your profits aren't increasing every year.
Exactly.
And the interesting thing about, talking about you know, collective campaigns, but talking about individual campaigns with these three girls, as we understood it. The manufacturers are quite happy to provide a one-off payment of 100,000 UK pounds. And, you know, if you do the maths on that, that's probably enough to last, you know, given the treatment and the therapy and whatnot that the girls need, probably last about 18 months. And then you have no recourse whatsoever.
Right, because you've signed an agreement that you'll keep your mouth shut, and this is it. That's all the money you're going to get. Could you briefly describe? We are actually starting to run out of time. Can you briefly describe part 2 and 3, not for the greater good and a penny for your pain? We've probably covered the issues, but just describe what's in them.
We have covered those issues. The litigation I did leaping across countries. And the second one, a penny for your pain, was all to do with Professor Exley, what's in the aluminium, what's causing damage. Do you want to talk briefly about criminally false, or do you want to leave that?
You read my mind. We still have about 10 minutes, so yeah. Tell me about your new joint film project, and I should disclose that I played a role in this, and I should also disclose that I didn't get paid for it, although actually I got some of my expenses covered. So I do have a conflict
you
there.
You inspired this, criminally false, because you have spent a long time looking into this subject, and you've even given a speech on this in a legal conference in Portugal about HIV crime. So really, it's your subject. Andy and I simply put together a 10-minute report on, you know, the subject, didn't we, Andy?
It's very good.
The subject that Joan was talking about is that HIV-positive people who don't disclose their status to their sexual partners can be jailed. In Canada, it seems to be 2 to 3 years per sexual partner, regardless of whether the sexual partner becomes HIV-positive or not. And, you know, in some cases, men have had multiple sexual partners, and, you know, if you multiply even 2 or 3 years by 5, you're talking about a sentence that's getting up towards what Canada gives for a serious murder, which would be 25 years. Yep. So it's extremely draconian, and the science of HIV never gets into the courtrooms.
Yeah.
I mean, what did you find by doing this film, Andy? What did you learn?
Well, in terms of editing the footages from the interviews that you had gave us, it was shocking. Because, I mean, not only were his answers shocking, but his delivery was almost monosyllabic, and it occurred to me that his time in jail had been, you know, incredibly stressful and traumatizing for him. And just by virtue of the fact that he, you know, needed to remain as anonymous as was possible, again, shows just the terror that he clearly still feels that he's under.
And one of those terrors is, one of those coercions that I discovered that I didn't, it took me a while to realize, is that you're basically forced to take the drugs. Because if you're in jail, whether it's for HIV or it's mental illness or so-called mental illness or whatever, if you're prescribed medications and you refuse to take your medications, you're non-compliant. And when you go to a parole hearing, your parole officer says, you know, well-behaved but non-compliant to his medications, you're probably not going to get parole. And, you know, most jurisdictions, you will probably have a chance at parole at maybe a third of your sentence. So if you get a 15-year sentence, you might only have to spend 5 years in jail. So that parole becomes very important, because if you keep getting refused parole, you're going to spend 15 years in jail, not 5. And although being out of jail on parole is not a whole lot of fun either, having to report to your parole officer and keep your nose clean to an extraordinary extent, because even a minor violation can send you back to jail, it's a whole lot better than being inside.
But David, there will be people listening to this who will say, what right has somebody to make love to somebody without telling them they're HIV positive. There is this moral issue.
Yes. Yeah? Which is why, it's one of the things I talked about in my talk in Lisbon this year was the science, that HIV antibody tests do not detect the virus, they don't even detect antibodies to the virus because nobody's ever purified the virus. The fact that people in the 1980s who were sick were discovered to have high levels of these antibodies is not proof that the antibodies were caused by any virus, let alone a specific new virus, now known as HIV. What did you learn during the making of this film, Joan, that was new to you? Because you've worked on this issue of HIV and AIDS for a long time.
You did all the initial research. Mm-hmm. But Mo Aziz, our assistant researcher, he also did a lot of research around the world on this. And of course, what really shocked me was the length of the sentences and how in the United States the sentences can vary so greatly because the law is different in the different states. Yeah. There's one other thing. Of course, we featured in our film an American soldier mm-hmm. who went, I don't know whether we have time to go into this case. Do we, David?
Yeah, give a brief summary.
Okay, he went to a swingers party with his wife. He had tested positive, okay? But his superior commanding officer had said, listen, just make sure you tell people you're positive, but just carry on as normal. Because this guy was called Sergeant David Gutierrez, was as fit as a fiddle. Mm-hmm. 6'2", amazing, strapping figure of a man, right? Went to this swingers party. And made love, obviously, to all the people in the room. And his wife, later, when she was divorcing him, decided to reveal that he was positive, which, of course, caused the most terrible problems. And he was tried and sent to prison. And he was sent to prison, I think it was for 8 years. But, of course, you see, the person that we interviewed on this, called Clark Baker, of the Office of Medical and Scientific Justice, mm-hmm. he said he had helped the defense lawyers later. I'm trying to skip through this quickly.
Yep.
His case was thrown out. He was thrown out.
The case was thrown out, so the conviction was overturned.
The conviction was overturned.
Because they brought HIV mm-hmm. science into the courtroom.
Exactly.
And this I find this interesting as somebody I studied science in university, really wanted to be a scientist when I grew up. It didn't happen. I guess computer science doesn't count. But I've always been interested in the science, and I have all these people telling me that it's unscientific to question the HIV/AIDS paradigm. It's unscientific to question the safety of vaccines. That's what science does. And when science achieves a consensus and starts to exclude the minority who don't adhere to the consensus, that is not science. That's bullying. And it's very unscientific.
That's beautifully put. I wish I'd written it down.
Well, it's been taped. So you can listen to this show afterwards and write it down if you want. We're coming towards the end of our time, so is there anything that you'd like to talk about? Do you have any other projects on the horizon that you might work on in the future? Anything else to say?
I haven't at the moment, David. I'm just waiting to launch Criminally False, which features you in a very big way, and Andy's work, and Ollie Richards, who was the editor on it. I'm waiting to launch that onto YouTube, and that will be maybe in the next 10 days.
That's great. I'm going to really look forward to that. I always love looking at myself or listening to myself. Actually not, but I always... And it was a very strained interview due to the circumstances of maintaining anonymity. I felt very uncomfortable during the interview.
I think that's one of the pertinent sort of things about it, that there is an intensity and an awkwardness from both mm-hmm. of you, which which just, you know, sort of just highlights the gravitas of the situation and his circumstance.
Yes, yes. Yeah, we're very worried about maintaining anonymity, for sure. Well, I appreciate you sharing all this information on your three-part Sacrificial Virgins series, and I'll definitely talk more about Criminally False when it's out. I'll be excited to see that. I'll put a link to the YouTube page where you can watch all three parts of Sacrificial Virgins. Yes, one more thing I wanted to talk about is your funding, I believe, came from Bob Lepo and Christine Fiala. Do you want to talk about them a little bit, just for a minute?
Yeah. I mean, Bob Lepo is a philanthropist who has helped us in the past enormously through his support for those who were challenging the HIV hypothesis. Mm-hmm. And it was Bob Lepo's idea, actually, to do these short pieces for YouTube. And for that, I am deeply grateful. Christian Fiala, of course, as a gynecologist and obstetrician, is deeply concerned, not only with the HIV situation, but with the HPV situation, and is also knowledgeable, deeply knowledgeable about it all. And of course, we have to thank Peter Duesberg as well, who inspired me many years ago. When we were working on AIDS, he said to me, you know, Joan, the HPV thing is completely wrong.
Wow, and all these years later, you've managed to make a film about it.
Yeah.
Thank you both so much for joining me today.
Great to talk to you, David. Thanks a lot for the time.
I had a lot of fun. We even laughed a little bit.
We did.
I like you both. Thank you for coming on my show.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Joan.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to episode 162 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow, that's crow with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth.